given the choice, give me the choice between reading poems and talking, and I talk to you about it. So I should really start with the poems. And put on a serious face. I suppose you've noticed, like I've noticed, that poetry readings are nothing if not serious, with a capital of S. No coughing, no spitting, no laughing, no yawning. No, that's like being a man. So please feel free to make any noises you like. If you throw anything, try to make it paper money. It hurts less. You can wrap it in a coin anyway. I think of you when I hear certain songs that hold back the sunset, like the wedge that saves a sash window from disaster. But love is more than pleasing. Love comes to the prison and strikes. It carries off gates. It splinters doors. It's question, who's got life? Notes towards a love song. You are alarming as sun rays in Miss Havisham's lair. Obstinate as a bobbing cork. Resilient as cactus, as gorse, as sea pink. Exuberant as a sailboat's hull thrumming. Fragile as a pair of precious old boots. Obvious as an iceberg. Shocking as a real oasis to a mirage addict. Open-handedness. On the day your letter comes, the kitchen air is so changed, two butterflies feel at home. The landscape's the same, yet how little it takes for a watery sun to tear the grey and make washed fields emit pulsating green, or make me see the hillside scrub as knots of pubic hair, the firm full curves of the breast mountains that were always there. You take me through the gap to a country I know or thought I knew, and the difference makes me tingle like coarse sand under a pounding wave. Stormy weather. Somebody was humming that during the break. Stormy weather. Billie Holiday fans know stormy weather. Stormy bleeding weather. Stormy weather. Ours were not the kind that crackles down the spine, where the air thickens with dust clouds, the cut grass fleeing in scattered bunches, a yawning window banging the frame while papers on the desk nervously shuffle. They weren't the sort that darkens the kitchen while poplars show pale underwear to the wind and heavy drops flatten as they strike the street that's blotched, then black, then gleaming. No, our storms lacked that playfulness. With us, it was a defoliating wind that sent us tearing to our shelters, leaving a young child out in the weather. October storms that clogged the drains, bringing bareness and grey and drip and flood. Making. We're not made each for the other, you and me. Not made each for the other, but makers still. We make one another. Unmaking, we make, remake. I have some regrets about the next poem. I can see why Noel King, the dog in the doghouse, I can see why he chose Notes Towards a Love Song for the title, but in some ways I'm a bit sorry he didn't choose the next one. With another echo of a song,
There's a Paul Brady song which I think is called, it's one of his first albums, the Heart Station album in 1981 or two. I think the song was called Dancer in the Fire. I think that's what the song is called, but this is called, excuse me, Fire Dancer.
With a thank you to Paul Brady.
Fire Dancer. Four balloons in strong colors attached to dark strings that tug at a hand unseen behind a high fence. That card you sent was so much like you. Hearing from a mutual friend that you had again been torn brings back that image. Aunt Peter's Wendy, so eager to obey the imperious voice, so willing to jump on the wind's back. And a picture of a boy, briefly familiar with petrels, too young or too exalted to beware the sun's rebuff. I know that for you there is one purpose only. You are the clear-eyed fire dancer walking quiet toward the flames, red and yellow, green and blue. The words you wrote told me what I knew. You couldn't resist the colors, and you signed, of course, with love. Those were the ones I planned to read in a burst to stop myself from talking. But now that that's done, I think I'm going to give myself permission to chat a little. I always have far too much to say, and I always bring far too many poems to read, to every reading, everywhere. So I'll try and control myself just a little. Along with the love poems, which are most of the poems in here, and incidentally for whatever interest it may be to anyone else besides myself, I didn't consciously decide over the years to collect all my love poems and then wait for 20 years to put them all into a book, but that's the way it turned out. I seem to have saved the love poems. And there is a nice man called Pablo Neruda, who is now dead, and who did have a book that I must have come across a long time ago. And I don't know, my Spanish is nil, but he has a book called 20 Love Songs and a Song of Despair. And I thought, oh, I like that. So I think that must have been somewhere in the unconscious. So the ones I'm moving on to are, some of them are, I don't know why I get nervous when I use the P word political, but I do. I've met nice, respectable, decent citizens who think that poetry should be about the death of your dog, and about the daffodils, and about your mother, and, you know, politics. And I have very strong opinions about this. I mean, it has been said by people who are much longer on the road than me. I think Derek Mann said that in Ireland, contemporary poetry doesn't seem to include many political poems. And my strong view is, if poetry decides, whether kind of unconsciously, covertly, or any other way, to exclude anything from poetry, then I think seriously that poetry is in trouble. So if we decide politics must be kept out of poetry, sure, we might as well decide that you can express any emotions you like, Aidan, in your lyric poems, but not anger. None of that crap, if you please. Mr. Yeats did a bit of that, but well, he got over it. I really think, Christ, we should decide that we can express any feelings we like, but not anger. And I don't know why I should be, you know, putting those two words close together, politics and anger, but somehow, seem to go together in this banker's republic. This is very brief. If you yawn during this one, you'll miss it. Three lines. The tiger gives, the tiger takes away, cursed be the name of the tiger. In Donegal, where I live, I have been living for 10 years, The phrase, the Celtic Tiger, was not one you used in a pub among people you wanted to be nice to. Because if you chanted about the Celtic Tiger, you know, all full of enthusiasm about what our dear government like to call virtually full employment, you know. Virtually zero unemployment, you know, by which they meant there was 4.4% of the working population unemployed during the boom. In Donegal at that time, the number of people unemployed was about 3 or 4 times that. Donegal people they prefer if you talked about the fucking weather or about Charlie Hockey, but don't be talking about the Celtic Tiger. Because what they would say to you is, we haven't seen it much. It's a Dublin thing, is it? So I kept it out of my chair. This one is called Dole. And I dedicated it to Rita Ann Higgins, who has written with Dole. You tell yourself you're used to it. The no dogs allowed everywhere you raise your eyes. The request not to loiter once your business is done. Alice in Wonderland notices telling you where to go. The lack of bell or buzzer for you to call for service. You see a man standing to one side and knock on the clear glass, like a child playing runaway knock. Or you stand unspeaking in a queue of men too deep and silent, like mendicant laborers at the hiring fair, like bony ones wondering if the flour will be rancid. 9 others before you, then 8, now a full 15 minutes with no move, just a man adrift near an unlit pay window. He sees no one there and looks about him. Unsealing your lips, you ask your neighbor if there's a go slow. They're on their break, he said. And having decided to speak to the man who's sidled in, you think you let him go, because he looks a decent man who must have asked his friend to keep his place. And you can't find the breath for anger. And does he deserve abuse from you? You recall Steinbeck's preacher asked before they locked him up what had sparked fist fight and shooting. I answered back, he said. Sooner or later, before my time on this seat is over, I'll say something about this city in which I was born and from which I energetically fled when I was 18. But I'm just reminding myself to say something about it. This one is not about Cork, it's about Heathrow. And I suppose a slightly Corkonian, slightly Republican view of Heathrow. The bar at Heathrow, a shoddy place of headless half pints, where glory has an old fashioned sound, a glory mistaken. And now the old rules thrown aside, the mole like umpire blinking distantly at the play, beer like the piss of sacred cows, and all these discontented souls, unenthused by their surroundings, rush inside into hopeless grey or into the stirring rosy past. We are unlearning underdog tricks. They frown at the odd spectacle of creatures long unused to freedom, stumblingly discovering muscles long unused, who blink up at the high sky, at the trees that are not so high. A decent man who is not quite a Cork man called Tom McCarthy published that for me. And I will never forget it for me. I was telling somebody earlier on that when Tom McCarthy was editing State magazine, and he edited maybe other magazines too, his rejection slips were so delightful and so courteous, I asked him would he send me more of them. It's one of the things I enjoy about this poetry business, if you like, the business of sending out your stuff and waiting and hoping it'll appear in print. I have met people of the most extraordinary courtesy. McCarthy is one of them. People who just take enormous pains to make you understand that they have paid exact and close attention to what you've sent them, and that for reasons that are beyond their control, really, they can't publish your stuff. I mean, the kind of very depressing thing is, well, at one extreme end, the poetry magazine that loses your stuff and finds it after 6 months and sends you an apologetic little note saying, "We found this behind the fridge." Oh. But we can't publish. Sorry. And then there's that other stuff, you know. I think the most depressing rejection slips are the ready-made ones, the photocopied ones, with the blank space for your name. Oh. And you say, "He didn't fucking read." I will say something about Cork. I come at it indirectly. Years and years after I left Cork, I went to university in Dublin.
Yeah.
And years later, I got a job teaching in a community school in Mill Street, halfway between here and Killarney. And there was a very, I don't know, I just enjoyed it, a session with one class one day where we had done our work, and there was 5 minutes left, and well, they said, sir, we'll have a debate. And what they meant by the word debate, and what you and I might mean by the word debate, are not quite the same thing at all. Let's have a chat. So I said, all right, but we need a topic, you know, otherwise it'll be all over the place. So they said, what topic? I said, gossip. Well, every single person in the room, even the quietest and shyest girl or boy, had fervent things to say about the power of gossip in their lives in the small town of Mill Street. And when they had all said their say, they turned to me a bit sheepishly and said, "Of course you're from the city. You don't know what we're talking about." So I assured them in the most solemn tone that I identified with every single story that they told. The story that they told that stuck in my mind, the kind of representative story from that session, was a young fellow, 14 or 15, said, "Christ," he said, "I can't even light a cigarette in a shop at lunchtime in town, but if by 4:30 when I get home, my mother knows about it." And I thought, but I know this. I know this stuff. I've known it all my life. My father was a solicitor. He had an office at 20,000 Mile. And when I was about 20, 21, coming home for holidays from university in Dublin, wearing something 60s, you know, a grandfather's shirt, probably purple, t-shirt rather, you know, the couple of buttons on it, and probably lots of hair, and probably a pair of jeans. And I was in the same about in his office, and I went through the gauntlet first of his employees and secretaries and people, you know. But when I got into his inner sanctum and the door was closed, the lecture he gave me about the way I was dressed. And then, you know, he's saying, "But, you know, the people you have just passed in my outer office, they know who you are, you know." Mm-hmm. And you come in just like that. And just when I was kind of gathering my breath, I wasn't going to say anything back, I was just completely startled by this. He then took it one step further. He said, "And," he said, "when you leave this office and you step out onto the South Mall, those people know who you are too." And I thought, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, let me out of here. Let me out of here. And you know, one of the things, I'm sure you've heard it, I know I've heard it lots of times from people from Cork and people who are not from Cork. People will say, Cork is very clannish. Closed groups. Or people will also say the rather more foolish thing, everybody knows everybody in Cork. Now, I think there's something in that, but that's not quite it, I think. My experience says that within the same social group, everybody knows everybody. You know what I mean? Whatever social group you belong to, that in there, everybody knows who you are, what date you were born, what your second name is, what your mother's, what the color of her eyes are, and where you come from, and all this. That's why I was happy to get out of here. I'm also aware, like in a general way, just because I've lived for 64 years and I know that everybody is not like me, I'm also aware that the most nourishing thing the most nourishing thing for some writers is to do exactly the opposite, to stay in the place where you were born and never to move. I know that too. So I'm not preaching you should all fuck off for the years. I don't know how much time I should allow myself, having done all that sharing. About 2.5 minutes? Yeah. What may not be obvious to you, I mean, I certainly haven't said, but it didn't. Some people who perform in public, like poets reading their own stuff, are most nervous of a crowd of strangers. Some people are seriously terrified of only one group, and that's their own people, and their own friends, and their own family. Well, that's part of how I feel about Cork. I was very nervous at the prospect of this audience, in this place. And one of my paranoid kind of scenarios when I was starting to prepare stuff was, I thought, I'd better produce as many poems that mention the name of the city of Cork at the very start to kind of establish my credentials, so that they don't immediately start throwing things at me. There are two poems that belong to that group, just two quick ones. One of them involves driving away from Cork, and the other one involves driving towards Cork. Written when I was living in Mill Street. The unspoken. Startled by soft early light that floods the countryside to left and right, only the rear view blinding, I drive away from Cork, my foot steady on the accelerator, alert to changes in the phonetic of place. Inishkara, Inishkara, Inishkara. And I count the magpies, one, then two, our joys, our sorrow overturned, along the familiar route, letting a squeal out as I start down from the road's high point. I know, as I depress the pedal, that the day is warmly coloured by last night's declaration from the sick man in the hospital, fending off sleep to speak the words Victorian fathers left unspoken. If Mr. Brian Freed's famous play about Father and Son, Philadelphia, Here I Come, was deeply, firmly set in Donegal, I know I identified with it very strongly. For any of you who know the play, I mean, in a way, it's absolutely torturing play. An oldish father and his youngish son of 20 living in the same house, both desperate to communicate with the other, and both finding it completely impossible to do. And I say to myself, yes, was he from Cork or from Donegal, this Brian Freed? And incidentally, the art class that I've taught that play to, the queue of youngsters coming to me, whispering in quiet and saying, our house is just like that. I wrote to Freed recently, 50 years in Donegal, and I told him that, you know, because he's going to die soon when I'm 12. This is the other Cork credentials poem. The frog who would be as great as the bull. Although my car points towards the city of the marsh, the place I live and work shrinking in the rear view mirror, the image that occurs is a boot pulling up out of sucking ooze. You're settling in, she said, and despite November notions of dusting off possessions to pack them again in boxes, perhaps this is my life. To live like the inflated frog in a field that seems too narrow for the pawing cloven beast whose antics he rehearses, and make the odd sortie into a bigger world. I have two in my hand. I'll have to choose between them. Could you say it again?
You can both.
See, she said it again. Well, in that case. One of them is for Paddy Galvin. I wondered, you know, I thought, I have brought a book of Paddy Galvin's poems, and I thought I'd read one. But the last time I read in Cork, which is 15 years ago, Paddy was there in the full of his health long before the stroke and all of that. My visual image of Paddy is bramble bushes for eyebrows. eyebrows that stuck out of mine. But you knew Paddy was coming, you know, first his eyebrows came in the door, and then Paddy after that. Anyway, that time, 10 or 15 years ago, I tentatively said to the audience, and Paddy was in the audience, I said, I've been translating some songs from French. Does anybody know the name of Jacques Brel? And Paddy said, oh! So this is that text that I read then. And of course everybody knows, I think everybody in court knows, that Paddy wrote songs as well as plays and poems and autobiography and bloody Shakespeare. Do not leave me. Do not leave me, we must put out of mind all can be put out of mind that is already fleeing. Forget the time when words miss their mark, and the time lost in asking how to forget those hours when why sometimes struck at happiness core. Do not leave me. I will offer you pearls of rain brought from countries where no rain falls. I will ransack the earth until after my death to clothe your body with gold, with light. I will create a domain where love will be king, where love will be law, and you sovereign. Do not leave me. I will invent for you words beyond sense that you will comprehend. I will speak to you of those two lovers who twice saw their hearts catch fire. I will tell you the story of the king who died for not having been able to meet you. Do not leave me. The fire has often been known to spurt from the ancient volcano that had been thought too old. There exists, so it seems, scorched lands that give up more wheat than a better April. And when evening comes, do not red and black marry to set a sky ablaze. Do not leave me. I will weep no more. I will speak no more. I will hide myself there to watch you dance and smile, to listen to you sing and then laugh. Let me become the shadow of your shadow, the shadow of your hand, the shadow of your dog. Do not leave me. Do not leave me. Do not leave me. That was for Paddy of the bushy eyebrows. Incidentally, like, I lived in France for a number of years, and when I came home, I gave myself a sort of mission to translate a lot of that kind of material, which may be known to every citizen of France, Jacques Brel songs and Georges Brassens songs and all the rest of it, but outside the borders. Outside the borders of France, France is as much a little island as Ireland is. You know, none of that stuff crosses the border. I thought I would take on this mission. I will preach French songs to the Irish and they will throw cabbages at me. I'm finished with this one. Even if the nice lady on my right insists that I go on, I will stop after. The famous Scottish poet Hugh McDiarmid, who died in 1978 and who wrote at great length on lots of subjects, political subjects, intellectual subjects, nationalist Scottish subjects, he wrote hundreds of lines under the heading "The Kind of Poetry I Want." So I thought, well, he's dead, you know, somebody should do more of that. After Hugh McDiarmid, I want poems like guitars that kill fascists, poems persistent as the sea, powerful as Quasimodo, poems like wild poppies in Donegal ground, pungent as a sudden greenfinch, poems that censor nothing human, that sing like Paul Robeson, they singe the page, poems like mackerel that straighten fishhooks, they catch the curt sound of car wheels through puddles, poems dynamic with Yeatsian rage. These poems give the news due attention, poems that show lobelia's exact blue, unafraid of farting, of yelling, of rude red help, poems that detest the word untouchable. They scale the walls round the cabbage patch of the heart, poems with opened mouth and ears and eyes and pores, poems sharp beat with questions, spiked with exclamations, invisibly ink. Poems that challenge a minority pursuit. Poems that are not nourished by wine and politeness. They are poems both crafted and crafty. Poems that take you by the lapels and shake. And there's a second page. Christ, I don't. Sorry, I am.